One of the most important things that any law enforcement officer has to learn is how to talk to people. Nothing can get you in trouble quicker than your mouth, as we both well know. Everybody, you know, cops pop their mouths off and say something, and before you know it, you're in the sergeant's office, it's lieutenant's office, you know, having to explain yourself, and then you get IA'd and everything else. Or you say something stupid that comes and bites you in the ass later on. You've got to maintain, you've got to learn how to talk to people. And, you know, I'm not saying kiss their ass, but you have to listen to them. If you're talking, you're not listening.
Hey guys, don't forget to check out the Street Cop Training Conference, April 23rd through the 28th, 2023 at the Gaylord Opryland Resort and Convention Center. It's going to be a great experience. 5 career-changing days, some of the most profound speakers in the industry. Guest speakers include Rob O'Neill, the guy who killed Bin Laden, Kyle Carpenter, the youngest living Congressional Medal of Honor winner, Fox News host Tommy Lahren, Navy SEAL American war hero Jason Redman, Sheriff David Clark, Sheriff Mark Lamb, and Sheriff Wayne Ivey. You'll also spend time with all of our Street Cop instructors at this event Monday through Friday. We'll have a great lineup of courses in addition to our great speakers. It will be a week that you will not forget. You'll be thankful you came. You don't want to miss out. Check out streetcop.com on how to register. If you're going to use the room code, make sure you book it from Sunday through Friday. That's what the code's good for, and it's about half the price of the regular rate. But those rooms are running out, so make sure you sign up now. We'll see you there.
Street Cop.
Hey guys, welcome to the Street Cop Training Podcast. I'm your host, founder and CEO of Street Cop Training. My name is Dennis Bonino. I have with me today Gary Edgington, returning for his second time because we just went real deep on the first time around a couple weeks ago, and he was invited back because we had a great time. And it was a actually, I got a lot of compliments on that podcast, Gary. Like, a lot of people were like, that was really fucking good.
Thank you. I my wife listened to it as well and was so impressed by your interviewing skills. She's a TV producer, and she said, okay, this guy's good.
Oh, shit. Yeah. Go. Just let her know I'm not really good at much. I'm good at being a dad. I'm good at case law. I can interview people well, and I'm a fantastic lover.
Those are pretty important.
Yeah, everything else I'm not good at. I'm just mediocre. Gary, you know, if people haven't heard the episode before, just give us a little history of who you were, who you are now, and the book that you've written. And we'll start deep diving into the book a little bit, some of the cool shit you've done.
Sure. I'm born and raised in Southern California, in Culver City. And I started my journey in law enforcement in 1974, when I became a police explorer with the Culver City Police Department. And a couple of years later, I became a cadet, which was a paid employee. And my dad was in law enforcement. And prior to that, he was in the Coast Guard for 20 years. He got out as a senior chief. And in 1979, I was in the academy, in the third week of the academy. And he was stabbed to death by a crazy guy who shouldn't have been out on the street. My dad was able to get one shot into him, but unfortunately, that was not even close to breaking stride or rendering him unable to continue the attack. And my father was stabbed to death by this individual. And I continued my law enforcement career and moved on to Beverly Hills Police Department and had fun there and learned a lot and became a detective. And sort of that changed my career trajectory, because at that point in time, I realized that that's what I really enjoyed was investigative work, investigations, search warrants and surveillances and interviews and all that fun stuff. And went to the DA's office and continued that full time for quite a while. And then worked major narcotics and different fraud types of investigations. And then ultimately ended up at the California Department of Justice and worked the Bureau of Narcotics Enforcement, major narcotics for a few years, and then transferred over to the Bureau of Investigation and did that for a while. Worked counterterrorism starting in 1999 and with the Joint Terrorism Task Force in Los Angeles. Worked organized crime, which is kind of a joke in LA. It's not really serious organized crime. It's the Mickey Mouse Mafia out here in LA. And then, at least that's what they used to call it. Post 9/11, I stood up a counterterrorism task force for the Department of Justice, a multi-agency task force consisting of investigators from several agencies. And then in 2008, I retired and took a contractor job in Iraq as an embedded advisor with the Army, and did that for a while and redeployed home. And then started working on the book a little bit. At that point in time, I had an idea for a book while I was over there. And then started working on that, and then took a job as an advisor and a subject matter expert investigator for the Office of Military Commissions, and worked on the Guantanamo detainee cases. And then with the same company, I transferred back. That job was back east. And then ultimately, I was able to get back to LA and where my family was, and took a job assignment with that company as the counterterrorism subject matter expert with an intelligence analyst for the Long Beach Police Department Office of Counterterrorism. And then did that for a few years, and then got hired to be a staff member at U.S. Special Operations Command in Tampa, Florida, and did that for about 6 months, and got tired of being away from home, and came home and picked up this crazy gig that I've been doing now for about 10 years, chasing grease bandits. And we now live in Charlotte, North Carolina. We escaped Los Angeles a couple of years ago, and we're loving life. And we've got a grandson, and we're doing great.
When are you going to actually do something with your life? You know?
You know what? I know. I just can't sit still. That's my problem. I can't sit still.
I mean, how many more agencies are left? 3 that you didn't work for?
Yeah. 1 or 2 anyway.
Oh, my God.
But I didn't go to 3 police academies. I can't say that.
I often wonder why I what it meant in my life to have to go to 3 police academies. And again, believe me, I'm not the only person who went to 3 police academies. I know there's other guys out there. Matter of fact, my old partner went to 3 police academies as well. Shitty ones, just as shitty as the ones I went to be quite honest with you.
Oh God.
So let me ask you this. I mean, you got a lot of history in there of the law enforcement work that you did. What are some of the bigger profile cases? And again, they don't have to be like nationally recognized, but maybe stuff that you did that you consider to be bigger and high profile or very interesting cases in the 16,000 years you've been a cop.
Well, I worked when I was at the DA's office. I had there were a couple of narcotics cases that were pretty cool. When I was at the DA's office, I had a case that started out with one pill. And it was a counterfeit, sort of counterfeit, but real methoqualone tablet. And it was called Mandrax on the street. And they were going for like 10, 15 bucks a pill when I started out. And that particular case, I just kept doing by bus, you know, flipping the first person, rolling him into the second person, convincing that person to cooperate, flipping him into the next person, flipping him into the next person, flipping the next person, finally got to the source of supply for the drug. And it was a Mexican national from a well-to-do family in Mexico. And he had a girlfriend in West LA. And we knew when the load was coming through a confidential informant that I had flipped. And that was one of the things that I kind of prided myself on, was patience and being able to flip people and get them to rat their buddies out, develop a rapport with them. I took my time with them. And with this particular female, I was able to get her to cooperate finally. We had some of the coolest surveillance photos I've ever seen of a delivery and then exit with a bag full of money that you've ever seen. They are textbook, the bag full of pills and coming out with the envelope full of cash. It was like, I mean, they're just like fantastic photographs. And the coolest thing about that case was in the narcotics business, you rarely have an incident where you actually affect the price of drugs on the street. But in that particular instance, we actually did. We got the price of that pill up to 20, 25 bucks a pill from that case because we basically dried up the source of supply for a while. And that was pretty cool. I was pretty proud of that one. It was a fun case. We did a lot of buy busts on that case, which are always a lot of fun, run in screaming and, we're the police and you're not, that kind of fun stuff, and then sitting down with them and giving them a come to Jesus talk. And usually they did.
Well, sure. I mean, you don't have many options, right? You're maybe sometimes staring down the pike of a significant. Well,
what's interesting? The problem is always, unless they've got a lawyer who's savvy, they bring in some mope who, some lawyer who really doesn't understand how the game is played. They can really screw up the future of their client, really screw them over, because, if they don't cooperate, then they're going down. And we give them a sweetheart deal. And, if they do everything, cooperate, give us one or two or three cases, whatever the contract says, then they walk. And but a lawyer comes in and he starts screwing around with it and, strutting and making earning his money, he thinks or she thinks. And totally screws the client up. Happens all the time. Oh, yeah. And, frequently it is the kiss of death. When they bring a lawyer in, unless it's a good lawyer who understands how the game is played and really cares about their client, they can really screw their client up big time.
So. People get very confused on the difference between a law degree and somebody who's a competent attorney.
Oh, for sure.
Yeah, it's what most of them, people don't realize this, are fucking horrendous.
Yeah.
Horrendous.
Yeah. They don't really, they just simply want to bloviate and sound important and put their stamp on everything. Without really regard to the benefit of their client. And seen that so many times in my career, so many times.
Well, it was a lack of humility, right? The bravado. And I'll give you an example of this. We had a attorney when I ran a real estate team, my friend Dave Francis. He's excellent. Shout out to Dave. He's the man. Dave always had a cool, common, collected head when we talked about negotiations or people had complaints or there's something wrong with a house. And I would have oftentimes clients are like, I don't think Dave's fighting strong enough for me. And I'm like, hey, if you would like Dave to be a dick, you won't be in this house. Do you want to be in this house? And they're like, yeah. I'm like, so just let him do his thing. There is going to be some give and take here. We are trying to negotiate. We are not in litigation at a war here. We're talking about $500 to $1,000 in repairs. Like, we'll let you know if we think it's something significant that we should argue about. But we don't really have to argue. We're here to negotiate. And some of the best attorneys that I have seen, outside of having put a show on during a trial, which I understand why that's done, are intelligent, cool, calm, and collected, and don't let their emotions dictate.
Right.
But certainly not their hubris either, right?
Right.
And people don't recognize that just because you went to school doesn't make you good at something. I mean, doctors there are that are fucking terrible.
Right. Exactly. I mean, that's just the way things are. I mean, people, they get that degree and they go running around and they think they now own the world or that they're going to impact the world in some way. And, it's interesting. I don't know if you ever noticed this or not, but frequently some of the easiest lawyers I found to work with were the public defenders in many ways, because some of them were so tired of being lied to by their clients and that they basically were like, that you could just tell that they understood the situation. And they had a job to do, and they did it correctly. They didn't do anything that was, you know, not in the interest of their client, but they definitely understood the score. And I noticed that so many times versus brand new, fresh out of law school DAs who, God bless them, don't know shit. They're just getting their feet wet, and they just have no clue. They're coming to the world of criminal justice and law enforcement with zero experience and world knowledge. They spent their lives in school. They have no understanding of what the real world is about. And, you know, they have these individuals come in there and blowing smoke up their skirts, and they just don't see it coming. Versus the PDs, they're like, okay, I've heard this story before 5,000 times. I know my client's full of shit. You know, I've seen that many times.
Oh, yeah. And that coupled with a complete lack of humility.
Yeah. Yeah. Oh, yeah. Yeah. Yeah.
So you don't know, right? Just tell us. You don't know. You don't know what you're doing, and we'll work with you. You know what I mean? Guys always say to me, hey, we know what the law is, but our district attorneys, our prosecutors, they don't know what the law is. So what do I do when I do these things? They tell me I can't. And I say, you know, unfortunately, you're going to have to work with these people. So making them adversaries is not going to get you anywhere.
No.
And for some odd reason, these administrations from police departments are like, must listen to them. Well, technically, yes, but we can certainly work together to try to educate. And you're going to have to try to pre-educate these attorneys. Hey, here's a case. We intend on doing this. I mean, here's one that's so simple. People in this country. Well, there's one right now that's hot in the topic of our groups and our social media stuff. And it ebbs and flows. Sometimes it's different things. In the past, it has been passengers detained on motor vehicle stops as instant to the lawful detention of the driver. You don't have to. You can't identify them. You can ask for identification typically. But they can't leave. And if they leave and you give them a command, it's a lawful order under the Fourth Amendment, the whole nine. That's been one that's been interesting. That's another fun one that prosecutors have no idea what they're talking about in that one. But the most recent one is that we can't get lawful consent to search of anything, but namely on a motor vehicle stop, unless we conclude the stop, give them their documentation back, pretend, do a mock release to try to show voluntariness of a consent procedure that is not done under duress. Yeah, I know your face says it all.
What?
The crazy thing is 35% of cops, it's known as a trooper two-step. It's the quote unquote especially in the interdiction world, it's a trooper two-step. Yet nobody has any documentation of where this comes from. We actually have documentation, a case called Ohio v. Robinette, 1994, I believe, that says just the opposite. You don't have to do this. You get a lawful consent when reasonable suspicion exists to prolong the traffic stop or the detention. And to this day, you have people just like, well, that's not how we do it. No, I understand. You guys have been doing it all wrong. We know that. That's why we're here to fucking fix shit for you.
Yeah.
And you know, like, well, our prosecutors want us to do this. I go, yeah, because it's been the same thing over and over again, because that's what you think you have to do. Let's readdress this. And it's nice when I teach in a class and we have, you know, 150 cops, and half of them are like, we don't fucking do that. And they're like, well, we do. They say we have to. I'm like, well, you're in the same state as them. How come they don't have to do it, but you do? Does that make any sense to you? You guys having suppression hearings and getting your stuff thrown out because the consent procedure was illegal? And they're like, no. And I'm like, so what are we doing, guys? Let's get to the root facts of it.
Right.
And unfortunately, when we talk about this lack of humility, when you confront somebody who's a prosecutor and say to them, where does this come from? One, they don't know. But in two, they just go, I'm a prosecutor. I'll make the rules. I'm a legal person. Blah, 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 blah. Why don't you just deploy some humility and work with us, make our lives easy? And they won't, you know?
Well, you talk to a judge. I've been to
another one. Yeah,
Here's another interesting thing about judges when they look at a search warrant. Frequently, I've been to many classes where judges have said, look, prosecutors have a tendency to want to try the case within the four corners of the search warrant, and that is unnecessary. A search warrant requires simply a showing of probable cause and what you're looking for and all of that other stuff to satisfy the Constitution. It doesn't require you're trying the case. And frequently prosecutors have you put in everything in search warrants and can really make things way too complicated. And judges, I've talked to many judges that prosecutors want way too much in the search warrants, way too much. So
you only have a burden to meet of probable cause. You don't need proof beyond a reasonable doubt. People don't understand that.
Exactly. Exactly.
And I try to prepare people for what they're walking into when they're new. You've been set up for failure from day one. Let's face facts. And it's just basically on you to get unfailed. Right. You can't sit around and wait for these people to unfail you. They're not, you can't wait to be picked. You got to pick yourself. You got to go out. And we all, every instructor be like, oh, it's easy for you to say you own the company that we got to pay to come take training. Hey, fuckface. Every instructor here, 40 plus instructors at this current time in the history of this company, have all spent their own time and money and energy and effort and trial and error to try to get as good as we can possibly be so we can talk on the subjects and collect our own little cavalcade of facts and say, here, this is what we know. This is what we've collected. This is our experiences. Here you go. I spend 30 hours a week working on this program, putting out content for you guys. And yeah, there's a VIG when you show up, you want to take it in person for us to share it with you. But also, like this company too, we also share everything. We don't hold it hostage.
Right.
It's a different experience in church. You could watch church every morning at you know, on the weird channel that you, I think that channel is like, how did I end up on this channel, right? Every morning, like, you know, when you turn the TV on, you're like,
how did I get to this one?
who pressed the button? How are we here? You know, but if you like that kind of stuff, which is fine, watching it on TV and experiencing it in real life are two very different things. I don't even like conferences that are remote. I don't do live, like streamed conferences. I'll go, but I'll fly anywhere you want me to fly if I think it's worth it. I'll rather be there and experience it because I've done both. I know there's a whole different world for them, but
no, I agree.
What were some of the major mistakes you saw in your career, maybe early on, maybe ones that you've done regarding this job or investigations? What were some of the more profound mistakes or constant mistakes that you saw people engaging in? And again, not in malicious manners, but just one of the big crutches or Achilles heel of law enforcement. Hey guys, if you're enjoying the Street Cop Podcast, do us a favor and give us a review on iTunes or Spotify, wherever you're listening to us. Tell a friend. We don't charge anything for the episodes. We appreciate your support. Check us out on any social platform by putting into the search bar Street Cop Training. Give us a follow. We have a lot of free content coming out every single day that you might not catch here on the podcast. And it's important for you to be able to do your job more professionally. And we also entertain you as well.
Well, it all goes back to training. I can, as soon as you said that, I immediately thought of myself as a baby detective at Beverly Hills. Nobody ever sat down with me and said, this is how you talk to a suspect in a custodial situation. This is how, you know, the reason why you're doing this is you want them to throw up all over themselves and confess and make your life a lot easier so you can file the case and they plead out and everything, you move on and everything's great. Well, nobody ever did that. So I would go in and talk to these people as a baby detective and didn't know shit. Thought, okay, well, you know, I got a theatrics and dramatic and all of this other stupid shit that you see on television, which has no place in the real world. And then finally, one day, one of our sergeants, his name is his call sign was Sam 12. He's very famous. Sam 12 had this class that he taught on how to interrogate people. And he was very good at it. And he was very patient. And he listened to their bullshit stories and their whining and their complaining and acted like he gave a shit. And that's what caused them to open up. And that's what caused them to start giving you the opportunities to start whittling away and identifying the truth through all of the nonsense. And so I would say that that was probably one of the things that in the beginning, I probably was really, I just didn't know what the hell I was doing. And I was like that for several years before somebody finally said, hey, this is really how you do it. And I took those lessons to heart and carried them throughout my career. But I certainly had no. And when I was a patrol officer, I didn't know what the hell I was doing. I didn't know. I could have been far more successful, had been armed with that advice and that knowledge when I was a patrol officer. But I didn't really know, you know, because I watched what other guys did, you know, my training officers and that kind of thing. And so you know, what are you going to do, right? I mean, one of the most important things that any law enforcement officer has to learn is how to talk to people. Nothing can get you in trouble quicker than your mouth, as we both well know. Everybody, you know, cops pop their mouths off and say something, and before you know it, you're in the sergeant's office, it's lieutenant's office, you know, having to explain yourself, and then you get IA'd and everything else. Or you say something stupid that comes and bites you in the ass later on. And you've got to learn how to talk to people. And, you know, I'm not saying kiss their ass, but you have to listen to them. If you're talking, you're not listening. And, you know, a lot of guys, myself included, I talked too much instead of sitting there in dead silence. Because, you know, as you know, if you sit there and don't say anything, they're going to want to say something because they can't stand the silence. And so, you know, it's just these simple little things, you know, that unfortunately nobody really taught you, you know, back then. I don't know if they do now, to be honest with you.
Why was Sam 12 famous? Who was Sam 12?
Oh, my God. The guy was a detective for a million years. He's retired now. And he was a character, an absolute character, a hell of a detective, solved a lot of cases. When I was patrol officer, I'll tell you a story. I got a call of an assault victim at 509 North Palm in Beverly Hills. And it was about 1 or 2 o'clock in the morning. I just dropped off my partner who was writing a report. So I was by myself in the car. So I roll up to the scene, black out, get out of the car. And the reporting person is standing framed in the doorway, screaming, "Hurry, hurry, come quick. Paul Lynde's been assaulted. I think he's dead." Well, Paul Lynde is a famous comedian back then. I don't know, you know, remember the show Hollywood Squares and all these other things? Bewitched. He was like Dr. Bomb. I don't know who he was, like a character, recurring character on these things. A very flamboyant guy, very funny guy. Well, anyway, go in the house, and it was very strange, very surreal situation there. And went into the bedroom, the master bedroom, and Paul Lynde was dead, in an agonal position. He was, you know, naked and everything. And Sam 12 was the sergeant that responded, because it required the sergeant, the detective sergeant, to come out, because we didn't know if it was a natural or, you know, something else. And that was really my first exposure to him. And he knew what he was doing. He knew exactly what he was looking at. He saw some evidence on nightstand. He said, "Okay, I know what happened here." And that's what happened. And it was pretty interesting to watch. And he was just a font of information and knowledge, and an old school guy.
What was his personality like?
A really good guy, a really, really good, decent guy. You know, not bombastic at all, funny. You know, just a really good guy, a really good detective.
What else was he known for? If he was he famous in the Beverly Hills Police Department?
Yes,
or?
Yes, he was. Yes, he was. He was really famous as an auto theft detective. It's where he really earned his stripes. He's a big car guy back then. And, he really knew the auto theft game. And when I went to detectives, I went into auto theft. So he really helped me out a lot with auto theft, because there's a lot of little nuances with VINs and hidden VINs and chop shops and all kinds of stuff. And he helped me out a lot with that. And, was you know, a mentor in that regard.
Tell me about a little of the premise of your book. What do you talk about throughout the book? Why is it a good read for people to pick up?
That's a good question. Basically, Outside the Wire is a fictionalized account of a retired LAPD detective lieutenant who worked counterterrorism for a number of years, who's thrust into a war zone, Iraq, in 2008, who's never been in the service. So he's in a completely foreign environment where they speak a foreign language. And they have, at times, very odd and strange methodologies and procedures and ways of thinking that cause sort of an interesting conflict between the Rick, the protagonist in the book, and who's basically a guy who's a mission-oriented casemaker kind of guy, the guy who is like, either you're going to follow me or lead me or get out of the way because I'm going to make this case happen. And the bureaucracy and the bad guys and everything else are all standing in Rick's way as he unravels this multidimensional conspiracy with the help of an army physician by the name of Nancy Weaver. And it's a story of a fish out of water, really. A guy who is just sort of an everyday guy. He's not a superhero guy who is thrust into an environment he really doesn't completely understand, and how he makes do with what he has, and sees the case through to the end.
That's awesome. What motivated you to write the book?
Well, I'll tell you, it's a funny story. Actually, it's not funny. It's actually really tragic is what it is. The genesis of the book really began one day when I was walking home from the chow hall, walking back to my room. And I'd been talking to some other guys and heard that there had been another suicide on the base. And there had been like three suicides while I was there, young soldiers taking their lives. Wow. And there'd also been an attempted fragging at another forward operating base that fell within my area of responsibility. The individual that worked for me at that facility, I had other individuals like myself that were embedded advisors, civilian law enforcement people like me. And that individual was one of the reports so I was aware of what was going on, what he was doing with it. And he was drawing on his law enforcement experience to help the military guys sort out what happened and investigate the case. And anyway, so I started thinking, well, this would be interesting. What if a retired flatfoot like me was asked to help out informally on a multi-victim homicide case, like an Agatha Christie kind of, 10 little Indians sort of homicide situation. And so I started playing around with that idea a little bit. And then when I redeployed back to the United States, I started writing, started fiddling around with it. I thought, you know what? That's not really my thing. I'm not an Agatha Christie person. I'm a terrorism guy. So this is going to be a book about terrorism. And so that's how the story commenced from there. I've been interested in terrorism since the mid 80s, since before the Olympics in 84. I've always been fascinated by it. And so I used to tell people I was terrorism before terrorism was cool. I got to see the pre 9/11 world and the post 9/11 world and contrast the two. And so that's sort of what the book is about. I mean, it's about a big city cop that is trying to unravel a big case and doing it in a war zone.
That's awesome. Where can they find the book?
It's on Amazon and Barnes & Noble. Those are the two easiest places to find it. It's in a few bookshops, but primarily Amazon and Barnes & Noble.
Do the audiobook yet or what?
No, I haven't. I've been thinking about doing it, but I'm more concerned about the marketing and promotion of this book and starting the sequel. There's been enough interest and demand from people who are interested in the story of Rick and want more of Rick and his unique personality, that I decided that I'm going to write another one. So I'm going to start writing the sequel. So
I guess that's what's next for Gary Edgington, is going to be the sequel to Outside the Wire.
Right. Exactly.
It's going to be Inside the Wire.
No, actually, I do have a title for it, a working title. It's called World Way. And if you're from L.A., you'll know what World Way is. It's where LAX is.
What else is on the itinerary as you carry through so swiftly in life, besides being a grandfather, an author? You know, literally having worked with 94% of the law enforcement in the country. What else is left for you? What's the plans?
Well, I'm taking up crochet. No, actually. actually, I'm learning fly fishing, and which I really enjoy. There's a lot of fly fishing opportunities out here in North Carolina, and it's gorgeous country for it. And I'm a big guy when it comes to shooting and hunting and fishing and that kind of thing. And I especially love really, really old guns. I spent a lot of time playing around with old guns, like that beast up there on the wall behind me, a Brown Bess musket. So I enjoy tinkering with that stuff. And I think that between all of those things, and I also love history, which goes along with my love of the old guns. And there's lots of history where I'm at or out here. And I've seen many, many battlefields since I've been here. And I continue to search them out whenever I go afield. And so that's what I think is going to keep me pretty busy between my little buddy, Declan, and all these other little diversions. I think I'll be a pretty busy guy. So
it's awesome. Yeah. Well, listen, I want to thank you for coming on the podcast a second time. I'm sure we'll do this again in the future. I don't mean to cut it short in any sense, but we have another fucking one lined up in about 15 minutes, and I'm going to start getting yelled at. Yeah, we just knock a fuck ton of these out a day because I'm a psychopath. We just got a contract. I can't talk too much about it, but a hypothetical contract. And the guy said, well, I'd like to do four of these. It's a very lucrative contract. He goes, I'd like to do four of your classes. You could do them back to back if you want. And I'm like, you know, they're taxing 10-hour courses, and I got to travel in between throughout this larger state. He's like, you know, you could do them like 4 days in a row. And I'm like, fuck it. Let's do it. Like, let's just go. I'll try it out. You know what I mean? At the end of the 4 days. And you know, people ask me, how do you do things like that? Just like, you see the decision I just made, like, fuck it. Like, let's do it. Well, like, what's the worst that could happen?
When the door opens, be ready and walk through. You know,
man, I'm just ready for a challenge. And yeah, it probably sounds ridiculous to somebody who may run an ultra marathon race of 100 miles, mm-hmm, but I'm like, oh, woe is me. I have to go teach in front of 100 cops 4 times, mm-hmm, right? In a air conditioned room with water and coffee. People don't realize, like, honestly, as nuts as this sounds, teaching large groups like that in the style that we teach, with a lot of emotion, a lot of enthusiasm, a lot of energy. Oh, it's fucking, I honestly would, this may sound fucked up to say, I would probably think that some intensive yard work is easier than that. Because I got to tell you, I've done intensive yard work. And at the end of the day, I'm like, all right, that was tiring, right? I'm a little, but I'm not, when I'm done teaching, I'm like, oh my God, I need a fucking bed.
Yeah.
I got to shut off. I need to like watch Discovery Channel and just veg out. And
yeah.
And that, so it's very interesting. And a lot of our new instructors were like, dude, I'm exhausted. I'm like, yeah, I know. That's fucking, people don't realize it. Like, when we teach the way that we do, it's exhausting. But man, it's awesome to have you here. And it's great seeing you again, man. I had such a wonderful time last time and this time. And
me too.
You know, too, all the best, my friend. I hope to see you again soon. Guys, if you're in an area where you're trying to get to our classes, but we're not close to you, fret not. We actually have on-demand training at StreetCop.com. You can take that course online right now, and then you could attend that training in the future at no additional cost. You can redeem your voucher, so you get 2 for the price of 1. We don't want to deny you the ability to take this training now, especially knowing that it can keep you safe at a very minimum, putting bad guys in jail where they belong, and at the maximum, going home to your family. Check out StreetCop.com for that offer.